The Fox City Score chapter and WHBY are pleased to bring you Biz Talk. Join Pat Lowney as he talks to entrepreneurs and professionals who share their experiences from starting to sustaining growth. Learn the skills needed for your business to be successful and get interactive by calling 281-1150. If you missed anything, you can catch the Biz Talk podcast at www.biztalkwithscore.com. And now, from the Myron Construction Studio, it's Biz Talk on WHBY.
Good morning and welcome to Biz Talk. I'm Pat Lowney and I'm glad to have you here this morning. We've got a full bench this morning. We've got Terry Pinch. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Pat. How are you doing?
I'm good.
And welcome to the week before Thanksgiving. It's hard to believe, but it's it's 5 days until Thanksgiving now.
Yeah, it's coming fast. Right. And we also got Sarah DeBruin with us this morning. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. How are you, Pat?
I'm good.
Good to be here.
Good to have you here.
A little cold. I just came in from Florida last night.
Well, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Yep, that's right.
And our guest this morning is Mike Bendel. Hi, Mike.
Good morning.
And Mike, you are an attorney that specializes in intellectual property law.
I am.
Want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I got on the path of intellectual property a long time ago. I didn't know I was going to go that route. I had this vision of being a lawyer for some reason, and when I was young, and kind of in the back of my mind, kind of that kind of percolated. Got myself up to college here at St. Norbert's in De Pere, and was going through the programs there as a math physics major. And my physics professor thought, I don't know that I see this guy being a real strong engineer or going on a technical path, but thought there's this thing called patent law that you could go into. And I said, I have no idea what that is. I didn't have attorneys in the family, but he put me in contact with some local folks, so I checked it out, and I thought, that'd be a good thing to do. I liked combination of my math, my technical background, and writing, and a lot of reading that we get to do as lawyers. So I pursued that and focused on intellectual property, patents, copyrights, trademarks, trade secrets, and went to law school down in Chicago that specializes in that, the John Marshall Law School, and then started out a small IP intellectual property boutique firm in northwest suburbs of Chicago. Got an opportunity for attorneys there, and then parlayed that for a few years out in New York, upstate New York, to a little bigger intellectual property boutique, 25 attorneys, and then got an opportunity to come back to the Midwest and was recruited by Kimberly Clark to come in-house as in-house patent practitioner there. And then was there for almost 18 years till earlier this year. I decided I'd strike out on my own and just opened up my own practice here just about a month ago. So kind of come full circle from where I started back almost 24 years ago and kind of trying to do it again. Really love working with inventors and entrepreneurs, small businesses, help them understand what this kind of nebulous concept of intellectual property is, how it can, what do they do, what does it mean to their business, and really help them protect their ideas so that they can at some point grow themselves as big as they'd like to be, because intellectual property, especially nowadays, is really a foundation for making that happen in our very knowledge-based age.
And, for a small business owner, sometimes it's kind of scary when you mention the word patent. But there's a lot of other things a small business owner can do to protect ideas before you have to go to the patent route. Can you kind of give us a timeline maybe to what a small business owner would do to protect an idea?
Sure, sir. Yeah, that's a great point. So patents is one of those pieces of intellectual property. Maybe I'll just give a broad overview of the other pieces. And patents in particular is the most involved, the most expensive, the longest to get. And then consequently, it gets you the best protection if you can get it. But it's not always available. So on the other end of the spectrum, you have what are called trade secrets, which is any confidential information you as an individual or as a business owner kind of create that helps you set yourself apart from the competition. And anytime you keep that information within the walls of your business, or if you share it with others, you do so under a very particular way. And I'll get to that, the next type of intellectual property protection. But then if you keep that secret, it's called a trade secret, and it gives you an advantage in some way. to be a better commercial entity. The next up the scale from a little more complicated is an agreement, an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, or confidentiality agreement. And that's used to protect your confidential information when you need to share it with others, because we all know that you can't do life and you can't do business all on your own. So you're going to need to engage vendors and other partners along the way. And when you do that and you want to make sure that your particularly created confidential information is not going to go out there and be free for the public to use, you do that under an agreement, a confidentiality agreement, or often called an NDA or non-disclosure agreement.
Who would you as an inventor be looking to use an NDA with?
It would really be, initially you'll want to have what I call non-confidential conversations. You'll talk generally about what it is that you're doing, what your needs are. So say, for example, you needed to engage a manufacturer to help you make a prototype. So you have an idea, you can do it on paper, you can figure it out, you know this is going to work, but you really need to engage a manufacturer to come up with a prototype. And that could be a variety of ways that they do that, but you're going to have to share some detailed information in order to have them help you build a prototype. And at that point, you'd want to have an NDA so that when you share your detailed information, you have some comfort that they can't take that information and run with it themselves and do whatever they want, or share it with somebody else and then basically take that. So by doing your NDA, you feel comfortable that you share it with them for your purposes, for your business goals, and that's where it will stop.
Building on that a little bit and actually going back to trade secrets, how do you decide, as you work with a client, what can legitimately be classified as a trade secret, what really needs a non-disclosure agreement, where a contract should be in place? But it seems to me trade secrets would be very difficult to protect. So how do you go about doing that with NDAs?
Sure. Great question. Let's talk a little bit about, give a little more context to a trade secret. I think a lot of these words, they all sound great, but you really need to delve into a little of the detail. So from a trade secret, the epitome of a trade secret that you hear about out there, the formula for Coke. The formula or the ingredients that are in Kentucky Fried Chicken. And a couple examples of, those are, ideas that only a few people in the company know what the actual information is. So those are going to be, let's say that's kind of your extreme example. There's a lot other information that you have that can also be a trade secret. It could be your customer list. It could be your product manufacturing specifications. It could be your vendor list that for particular vendors that you know are great for marketing services, great for whatever needs you as a business may have. It's those things that you're going to have to, at some point, you put some time and effort into developing that information. Sometimes I guess you could stumble upon something and find it's a key piece of information. It's going to take a lot of time and effort, but it's a piece of unique information to you and your business. This may not be unique out in the world. You may be combining it in a new way, but it's information within your business that other people don't know that you necessarily have.
Sure, it gives you an economic advantage in the marketplace versus, other competitors or other people trying to do the same thing, especially, pizza sauce or whatever for
Correct.
A trade secret.
Right, and there was some trial and error that you maybe got to get to that piece of information. But it's not, to your point, Terry, it's not everything. So what I had for lunch yesterday may be confidential because people don't generally know it, but that doesn't give me a competitive advantage, generally speaking.
And trade secrets, you can keep them forever as long as you take steps to treat them as trade secrets. And only, can you talk about what some of those steps a business could take to keep a trade secret secret?
Sure. So within the example, the typical lawyer answer is it depends.
Right.
So depending on how valuable that secret is, you may have to take more steps. So for example, I'll go back to my Coke example. They literally have a vault where the Coke formula is written on a piece of paper, and it's kept in that vault, and there's only a couple employees that even have access to the vault. And from a vendor perspective, none of the vendors know how all those pieces go together. They may know bits and pieces, but none of them know all of it. Similar, again, these are extreme, but the formula, the ingredients for Kentucky Fried Chicken, my understanding and based on some research I did is there's only two people in the company that know what all the ingredients are, and each of them doesn't know all of them. So it takes the two of them putting their knowledge together to understand how these get combined and how you order them so that, again, no one person knows all the ingredients. Now, that's an extreme example. Things that are less extreme would be the information that you may have, your vendor customer list. You keep it within your company under, you know, it's not something that all your employees are going to know. It's something that you keep in a confidential file. If you need to share it with others, you're using one of these NDAs, confidentiality agreements, so that whoever's being shared with, there's a business reason you had to share it, because they maybe need to help you do your soliciting of, you know, new customers or new vendors. And then it's under confidentiality agreement, so they know that they can't take and do whatever they want with it. So it's those types of measures from a secrecy. It really comes down to, if it's a piece of physical information, how do you keep that physically secret from the other stuff within your company, even so that if vendors are coming through, they can't see that piece of physical information.
Right. And what about asking employees to sign an NDA as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. Starting out that everybody who's going to have access to that information from your employees to others needs to be under some type of confidentiality agreement. Or otherwise, the general rule is information's free to share.
And that's actually where I was going to go. Make this clear for me, what I believe is what you're saying is a difference between really trade secret and a patent is that if somebody goes out and they take an idea, find that sheet of paper in the safe and go and use it, that's a legal issue. But if somebody out in the street just happens to come up with that same formula, because it's a trade secret, that's okay. They didn't get that information from anybody else. Is that true?
That's absolutely true, yes. If you independently develop the trade secret information, everybody, whoever the developers are, can own that. So that would then – now, two people could still have the same trade secret as long as that information is not generally out there for the public. And two, three, four, five could. In fact, I'm willing to bet a lot of companies have some very similar information in the technology areas that they compete that works for them. And it's as long as it's not generally out there, that is still a protectable trade secret. Now – do we take your example a little different direction? When does that trade secret, what do you do, or how, if you know you need to put it out there because it's got to be in your product, that particular piece of information, it's a new way of making a pencil or a pen, and once you've made that and you put that product out in the public domain, anybody could, what they call reverse engineer it, could look at it, could figure out what that secret is and then go take it with themselves, then you'd want to pursue patent protection. In fact, these other forms of intellectual property protection that we talk about, other than trade secret, other than an NDA agreement, are all designed so that, and in fact, you have to register, you have to tell the government, this is what I believe my property to be, and I'm willing to share it with you, the government, so that I can get the exclusive rights that are gotten by particular forms of intellectual property, like a trademark, a service mark, copyright registration, or a patent. Because then the practical reality is you need to use that information in public, and the government says, we'll give you some protections. Now, some of those, trademark, can live on forever. Trade secret can live on forever, as long as you keep them in their domain of what they need to be. Patents have a limited life of about 17 years. It's 20 years from your filing date, but it takes about 3 years to get a patent through the patent office, so effectively you get about 20 years. And in fact, you could get pre-infringement or pre-damages during your pendency if someone were to use your idea, so it potentially could be 20. And copyright can live on, life of an author plus a number of years, 75, 95, depending on what
the creation. I think it's 70 years for an individual and 90 for a company, if it's a company that owns a copyright. So, yeah, basically the point is a trade secret is something that's not going to be reverse engineered once it's out in the public. But if it is or could easily be copied, you'd want to patent it.
Absolutely. Right.
Right.
And there's another little nuance under the patent law that even if it's not reverse engineerable, if your idea is actually out in something, say it's the innards of a machine that people can't physically see, it's still considered out in the public domain, so you either need to choose to patent it or not.
Yep, that makes sense.
So we're talking to Mike Bendel this morning. He's an intellectual property attorney in Appleton. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you've got a question for Mike on anything we're talking about, you can call 920-281-1150 or toll-free 866-887-1150. You're listening to BizTalk and WHBY, and we'll be right back.
I am attorney Sarah DeBruin, owner of Legal Business Edge, and I want you to know your options. Your legal business concerns are important to me. Legal Business Edge delivers value by working as a partner with you, our client, to help you understand your legal options. Focusing just on business law, we take the time to get to know your business and develop a legal strategy that will help you reach your business goals. Whether it involves intellectual property, contracts, negotiating for your rights, buying or selling a business, or organizing your business structure, Legal Business Edge gives you the creative legal options you need.
Sarah DeBruin provided our company solutions that saved us time and money, as the quality of her guidance and diligence provided creative solutions unparalleled by other attorneys.
Know your options. Call Legal Business Edge at 920-851-7761 or visit LegalBusinessEdge.com.
At Alberts & Hayling CPAs, your success is our success. We can clarify any tax situation and help your business take the steps in managing it confidently. We offer services from startup to sell-off, including payroll, bookkeeping, accounting, and more. Visit AlbertsHayling.com today. Alberts & Hayling. Personal connections, positive results. Securities and advisory services offered through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Tax and accounting services offered through Alberts & Hayling CPAs, which is not affiliated with Woodbury Financial.
Do you believe your business can generate more in profits, be more efficient, and grow successfully? At Priora, our vision is applying financial literacy. Yours. You are searching for a method to truly understand and manage the cash flow of your company. You know you should have a better working knowledge of your cash flow. The Priora Business System is an excellent template for the motivated business owner to successfully achieve profitability and growth. Visit PrioraCFM.com for more information or call Tony at 920-450-2840.
Welcome back. We're glad you joined us this morning. We're talking to Mike Bendel, and Mike is talking about trademarks and trade secrets, and we'll get right back to that. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the Fox City Score Chapter. BizTalk is brought to you each week by the Fox City Score Chapter, and our chapter is located in the Fox City's Chamber Building in downtown Appleton. We have offices in Appleton, Oshkosh, and Fond du Lac, and we serve an 8-county area. We have 50 volunteer mentors, each an expert in their field. We offer entrepreneurs no-cost and confidential mentoring. We have expertise in areas such as IT, social media, marketing, cash flow, accounting, strategic planning, workflow, HR, retail, best practices, and many other specialties. In order to register for a no-cost and confidential mentoring session, or to learn more about the Fox City Score Chapter, visit our website at foxcities.score.org. You can learn more about how the Score Chapter can assist you with starting and or growing your business. When visiting our website at foxcities.score.org, you can complete an online application for a no-cost, confidential mentoring session. You simply complete the online form and submit it to SCORE. Within a few days, a SCORE mentor will be contacting you to set up a meeting. Remember, SCORE is no-cost and offers experts who can offer you assistance in many different areas that your business may need. To get started, simply visit our website at foxcities.score.org. And to support small business people, Fox City Score is always looking for new mentors. We could use people right now with experience in agriculture like hydroponics, wellness such as assisted living, government contracts and construction. So if you have interest in helping out, give us a call or go out to our website, foxcities.score.org, click on the volunteer button and fill out the short application, and we'll get back to you shortly. So we want to get back to Mike.
Yeah, Mike, in the first session we had talked about on the spectrum of intellectual property, the least expensive to obtain and the easiest to obtain, and that is a trade secret, obviously, and then the non-disclosure agreement. Where do you go from there? What are other types of intellectual property, and how do you get them, and what do you protect?
Sure. So moving up the spectrum, the next one would be a copyright and copyrights and a couple of aspects about copyrights. You can copyrights are created the moment you put a creative work into a tangible medium. And nowadays, tangible medium obviously is a piece of paper, but more importantly nowadays is digital. Anything electronic, anything when you, I like to tell people, you move it from your head to somewhere else so it can be reproduced in some form and shared with someone else. Once you've done that, in the U.S. and in most countries, in all the industrialized countries, copyrights exist. And they exist from the moment from that moment of creation. And they'll last for a period, you know, a pretty long period of time. Now, the next step you can take is you could register your copyrights. Well, even before that, you could put a notice on your work that you'll see as a legend. It's usually the year created and whoever the owner of it is along the bottom or somewhere in the margins because you don't want it to take away from the creative work. But you give a notice that you're claiming copyright. So that's another way to establish your rights. And then even better, but doesn't apply in all cases, would be registering your copyrights. You would register them. It doesn't create your copyright, but what it does is it makes a public statement to the government even more so that says, I am claiming copyright in this very particular thing. And what it does get you is when and if you have to do an enforcement action, you have more tools available. Number one, you have to have a registration to go to any type of a court action, and it's always federal court you're going to for copyrights. And then number two, when you have your registration in place before an infringement happens, you have more tools available in terms of types of damages that you can get.
Let's talk a little bit about some digital creations that are protected by copyright. For instance, the coding behind your website, is that a copyright issue? Or if you come up with some computer program, would that be a patent issue?
That's a good point, Sarah. That could be both. So the coding, the details as to how you make things look the way they do is oftentimes going to be copyright protected. You could protect that at that level. And then but to the degree you have higher level functionality and it's a new way of maybe presenting pixels or a new way of sending information electronically, that could oftentimes be protected by patent if you're the first one to do it. We'll talk a little later, a little more details on what is a patent and how you get a patent and some of the high level aspects of that. But yes, you could do both in that scenario.
That's a good distinction and something small business owners should know about owning your own website. Is it the person who made it for you, or how do you get to own your own website if you go out and hire somebody?
Excellent question, because there's often a misnomer here. And I've, in fact, I've worked with a designer to help come up with some of my logo and artwork as I'm starting my firm, and had to do a little education on that end as well, because most people assume if I pay for something, I own it. Well, in copyright world, in patent world, in intellectual property world generally, the owner is the one who creates it. The creator, the maker, is going to be the owner initially. Now, in certain cases, you could have, if you're an employee hired to invent or hired to create, then there are some exceptions under the law that say those positions necessarily make the ownership reside in the employer. But the general rule and what people need to assume is if it's not your employee, if you're hiring someone as a contractor to build your website, if you don't have a written agreement that says you're going to own the copyrights in that work, you won't. Your creator, your developer will. And so then what does that mean? I think the practical reality is most of the creators and owner or the designers don't know that, and they assume once you pay for it, you own it, and they're not going to hassle you about it. But technically, you don't own it. And to take it and then make improvements, or if they, you know, you're unhappy with your designer and you have to pull it out of their hands, you could get into a fight about who owns it, and in fact, you wouldn't own it.
Right. That copyright creation bit of the owner is so strong that you said the only way to transfer it is by an agreement of some kind, assignment agreement or a work-for-hire agreement. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So within the context, there are some by operation of law agreements. If you're an employee in a work-for-hire context where there's certain categories of information created, the employer will automatically own it. But let's treat that as the exception, because it is in the smaller bucket. Most often, what you have to have is some type of written agreement that recognizes who's going to be owning that. So what you'll find in most cases from an employment perspective is they'll have, we talked earlier about confidentiality, you'll usually tag together those two ideas of confidentiality and what we call intellectual property rights assignment that your employees assign. So you don't have to worry about who's going to own stuff when your employees are creating information on company time and or with company resources. So you'll have a written agreement with your employees that they'll keep stuff confidential, number one. And number two, if they create intellectual property rights, you as their employer will be the owner of those.
And what you need is that sort of same type of agreement with the third-party website developer or anyone else you do your logo design with?
Absolutely. Yeah. You'd do that. And that would be, and that's one of those, if you think of, well, why do I need a lawyer? Why do I want... That's some of that early development work, that relationship work, you need to put into writing, because if you don't, you're going to end up paying for something that and walk away without owning the thing you thought you would own. So, and it's not terribly complicated. It doesn't take a ton of time. And once you do it a time or two with a lawyer, I think you get a good template as to what to do the next time and how to be involved in that. But as I wouldn't go, and I can do marketing on my own, I'm not really good at it, and I could do lots of other things on my own, but I go and engage vendors who are specialists in that.
Absolutely, and that goes way back to non-disclosure agreements. You really probably, as a new business owner, want to use an attorney to draft that agreement, especially if there's ideas and intellectual property involved.
Correct, and usually it's not too it doesn't have to be too terribly complicated, but you get the right person who knows the right things, and it'll go well, and you'll know you got what you paid for.
Right.
Do you have situations where people come back later, like on a website example that you used, where they'll come back and realize they want to buy that or take control over that, that they don't own that?
I will, or when you sit down and talk with them and say, you know, did you have a written agreement with your developer and as to copyrights, and they say, no, I didn't. And I say, well, okay, probably not a big deal. Your developer's probably going to think you own it and you're going to own that. So what we do here is just put in place a copyright assignment, ask your developer to sign it, and in every situation I've been involved, they'll willingly sign.
You have to ask.
That's been my experience, but you have to ask.
Okay, well, we're going to take another break. You're listening to Biz Talk and WHPY.
Fox Communities Credit Union.
Right now at Fox, you can make a 3.08% APY 15-month certificate happen. That means you can make brighter futures happen, make bigger nest eggs happen, make more happen. Earn 3.08% APY with a 15-month certificate from Fox Communities Credit Union. This special rate ends November 23rd, so don't miss it. Fox is helping you make life happen. Get the 3.08% APY 15-month certificate, only for a limited time and only from Fox Communities Credit Union. Don't miss this rate. Visit one of 22 Fox locations or foxcu.org for details. Offer ends November 23rd. Hurry before it's gone. APY is annual percentage yield, $10,000 minimum certificate balance requirement. Rates and terms are subject to change, and you must meet eligibility requirements. Insured by NCUA, visit foxcu.org for details.
Fox Communities.
Are you feeling less than confident in your personal or business finances? At Alberts & Hayling CPAs, we work with individuals and small business owners to simplify finances and help maximize profits. From asset protection to tax planning and more, we'll guide you through a financial plan. Visit AlbertsHaling.com today. Alberts & Hayling. Personal connections. Positive results. Securities and advisory services offered through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc. Member FINRA SIPC. Tax and accounting services offered through Alberts & Hayling CPAs, which is not affiliated with Woodbury Financial.
Are you a business owner looking to purchase real estate or equipment? Did you know there's a program out there that any bank or credit union can offer to help you make it happen with as little as 10% down and long-term fixed rates under 5%? It's called the SBA 504 program, and it has been working for small businesses for over 35 years. So next time you are talking to your banker about real estate or equipment financing, make sure you ask them for the SBA 504 option, because knowing all of your options is good business. Learn more about the SBA 504 program at WBD.org.
Welcome back to Biz Talk. I'm Pat Loney, and I'm here this morning with Sarah DeBruin and Terry Pinch. And we're talking to Mike Bendel. He's an attorney with Bendel Intellectual Property Legal in Appleton. And we're going to continue on the conversation and move into trademarks, right?
Yeah, we were talking about copyrights. What's the difference between that and a trademark? I get that a lot of times, that question a lot for many clients.
Yes, there can be a little overlap between a trademark and a copyright, but the fundamental of a trademark is it's a brand. It's a source recognition device. So when someone sees that word, name, symbol, they come to think about something in particular. They don't have to know who the corporation is, who the owner is, but it gives them that warm thought in their mind. It could be a good thought or a bad thought, but you see a Hershey's candy bar, you have a particular idea about what that candy bar is going to be like on the inside. You hear the chimes on the NBC on TV, and that sound tells you, oh, that's that particular channel. It could be a smell you can trademark. But it's anything that's what they call source identification. So when you see that word, name, symbol, smell, whatever, it gives you an idea about that what that thing is.
Also, it tells it how valuable, you know, a product is. For instance, you slap on the Apple, you know, logo or the Apple symbol, and you have a certain idea that these are really, you know, high tech, you know, and quality reputation items.
Correct. And it's that source identification and gives you an idea of quality. I say it doesn't have to be great quality. You know, you get something that has very high end, or you could have something low end, but at least it gives you that consistent message of when I got this thing, that's what I'm expecting.
Yeah, you mentioned the smell. A smell can be trademarked. I think Play-Doh, the smell of Play-Doh was trademarked in the last year.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Those are not the easiest to do, but you can do them.
Have you ever done one?
I have not.
Okay.
I've stuck. Yeah. So
talk about how do you get a trademark then?
Sure. So a trademark is a registration process with the U.S. government, in particular the U.S. Trademark Office, and you file an application. And basically in that application, you kind of put down your information, who you are, what it is that you're trying to trademark. And you just have to describe that a little bit. And like all good things government, you pay a fee. And then it gets examined. The trademark office looks and sees, is anything else out there like this that could be what they call confusingly similar? Because we don't want the same trademarks to be out there and protected, you know, if they're confusingly similar. That's not going to help the public.
Yeah, in the same commercial area.
Correct.
Because
yeah,
you could have one commercial area with a trademark and a totally separate one with the same name in a different channel of commerce.
Generally speaking, correct, unless you get a trademark that's really famous, like your Apple example. So
right.
Someone would be preventing from putting apples on shoes, even though Apple's generally associated with electronics.
Right.
But generally speaking, you're right. There's that what the confusion has to come from same channels of trade, same types of goods, so that it allows, you know, those retailers or sellers of the goods to make their mark and help the public identify what that means.
Right, and then your brand is protected. That's the reason the trademark exists, is to protect and build upon that brand. And how long do they terminate, or how long do trademarks last?
Trademarks their fundamental is based on use, so you can have them last forever. They can, and in fact, you don't even have to register your trademark. There's an advantage to registering a trademark, just similar to how there's an advantage to registering copyright. But your trademarks actually come into existence once you start using them to sell or market your goods or services. Then you have your trademark rights developing. The reason to do a registration is to give you broader rights where you may not yet be selling or marketing your goods. So you as a small business owner, you may think, well, I'm just selling goods in Wisconsin, but I have a vision to sell in the Midwest and ultimately across the United States. Why do I need a trademark now? I'm just in Wisconsin. Well, you may not need it, and in fact, you don't need it today, but for those sales down the road, once you do become popular, you want to make sure that your mark is still available. And for a relatively nominal cost, I mean, trademark all-in costs between government fees and attorney's fees, you can do $500 to $1,500, say on average $1,000 is what you're talking about. You then get to the ability to protect that mark for your use down the road. nationally. And in fact, you could go international, but that's yet another layer of cost and complexity. But at least nationally in the United States, for that $1,000, and mm-hmm. then you are guaranteed. When I do get to those trade zones outside of Wisconsin, then I'll know I'm going to be okay.
Right, right. And you can file a trademark with the state of Wisconsin, but that's really only showing use, or it doesn't really give you much protection, does it?
It's just within the state, and then the process for determining, how you get those are really is there's nothing identical, so there could be someone who's kind of close, which could cause some confusion, and I've run into that within the state before. And if all you have is your state trademark rights to rely upon, it's something better than nothing. Mm-hmm. And if you're then trademark use rights come down to who is first as well. It's generally whoever's first is going to have a superior right, but there can be some carving up that happens. It's been a little while since I've studied it, but there's either Burger King or McDonald's, where it was a local restaurant that started before the big conglomerate Burger King McDonald's started. They still own their restaurant in a local spot, and but they have to be, and they couldn't get run out of town by the big one, because they were first in that geographic zone. But
so
it's a bit unusual.
You mentioned, first to file, and that is a really basically a rule along the whole spectrum of types of intellectual property. Could you expand on that, and then we'll talk a little bit more moving into patents?
Sure. So kind of a theme for all of intellectual property is timing. So whereas in real estate it's location, 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 in intellectual property it's timing, timing, timing. Because if you don't do things at the right time, namely protect your rights through confidentiality or register your rights through certain type of registration, you run the risk of dedicating that information to the public. And what that means is, well, you can continue to use it, but so can everyone else. So from a registration, a timing perspective, in trademark, you can have a filing when you intend to use your mark in commerce, but before you've actually done it, to kind of put that stake in the ground and give yourself an ability to then actually use it over time before you've done so, because you're making a public record anytime you do a filing. So moving into patents, it gets more complicated. There's a procedure, what's called a provisional patent application, to kind of put a stake in the ground at a lower cost, and then that gets you some protection for a year, and then from there you'd have to do another type of patent application called a non-provisional patent application to more formalize what it is you're trying to patent, and then you're going to be going through that patenting process. So maybe a little overview of what that patenting process looks like from a timing and from a cost perspective might be helpful.
Sure.
So when you have your first idea and you're beyond the stage of sharing generally, you've got your NDA in place, your non-disclosure agreement, you share it with someone to help understand, okay, how commercializable can this be? What do I need to do? Then you're moving forward to have enough information on your idea to be able to maybe make a prototype, maybe share in more details with others, so you file a provisional patent application.
Talk about, even before that, how do we know this idea isn't already taken by somebody else? And how do you do a patent search, for instance? And is it something you do on your own, or should an attorney do it?
Good. Yes. There is, early on, to know, do I even want to do a patent application? Should I do a patent application? How unique is my idea? You would want to do a patent search. Nowadays, with tools that are out there, for example, USPTO.gov is one, Google Patents is another, you can do a fair bit of searching, Boolean searching, word searching mm-hmm. on your own to get some kind of idea. But ultimately, you'll likely want to engage, if you determine you do your searching and if you find there's nothing out there, because searching is, by analogy, you're looking for a needle in a haystack and hoping you don't find the needle. If you don't find that needle, it just doesn't mean it's not out there. It just means, at least at some point, that you haven't found it yet. So you can do some searching on your own through some of the public available tools. But ultimately, engaging a patent attorney and who usually engages a patent searcher, who this is their trade, what they do. They know how to look through patents. It's a combination of an art and science to try and find what is called the closest art to your idea. They'll look for that and help you find that. Because, for example, there have been over 10 million patents issued in the United States, and that's just in the United States. If you go globally, there's even more patents that have been issued, and all that information is in what's called the public domain, and it helps determine who's really got something new compared to what's come before. Because only somebody who's got something new from what's come before is going to get a patent on that new thing.
And that's really why it takes so long to get a patent. 3 years sounds like a long time, but the patent examiner is evaluating all that prior art and looking at it and trying to get you the best possible valid patent you can obtain. And, you know, then the presumption is your patent is valid and protected from infringers.
Correct, yes. So that patenting process, a combination of waiting in line to get your patent examined and then them looking through the art that's out there, considering what your art is that you've become aware of and how and why that means you should be able to get a patent. Because the government's going to give you what's called a license monopoly to practice that patent and to
manufacture and import even.
Correct.
So when you do this search, does the government take that into account once you apply for the patent so you can show what you've done, or do they start from scratch and do all the work themselves?
It's both. They take that into account. In fact, in the United States, you have an obligation to provide that information to the patent office. In many countries, you don't. But in the U.S., you do. And so they'll use that kind of as their starting point, but then they always do their own search as well to understand if there's other spots and places they should look for relevant information.
Okay.
We have a call on the line. Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Mike talked a little bit about the obvious protections due to copywriting or trademarking or patented. Do you, as a creator of an idea, do you expose yourself to new risks by applying for a patent or a trademark? Any other than cost or applying resources to applying for a patent, what risks would you expose yourself to, and would you ever counsel someone to not apply for a patent?
Great question. So let's take those in two parts, kind of from everything that's not patent, if it's trademark or copyright. The biggest risk is when you do a registration is you're making that information public in a public way. Now, your copyright, you may be sharing it on the Internet and sharing it other places as well, but by putting it in the copyright office, it's one more public place for it. Trademark, very same thing. In fact, some companies and what they'll do is they'll be very careful about how they apply for trademarks because it can tell their competitors what their commercialization plans are, why they're trademarking this new thing, this new product group that they've never been in before. So the risk is it becomes public and fairly quickly in trademark and copyright. Copyright almost right away, trademark as soon as the records get put in the trademark office record, which is almost right away as well. Patent, you have a little more time. There is still both domestically in the United States and internationally, your patent won't become public for at least 18 months, but they do get published after about 18 months from their filing, and if it did not get too technical, their earliest priority date, that will become published and available. So that risk is right there that you've made it public. Some of the things that you're thinking about, well, do I patent it or not? If you have a trade secret, if it's something that you can truly keep secret and it's not reverse engineerable in your end product or your end service that's out there, you may want to keep it trade secret because you can protect that forever, whereas a patent, you're going to have a limited time, you know, that about 17 to 20 years effectively. So that would be the risk is, do I make it public or not go public? If you go public and you don't get your patent, but you filed for patent, again, you've shared that with the world and you've just taught them more information than anybody would learn on their own absent that patent filing. So that's another thing people have to think about. And how enforceable is the patent? Is it going to be something that you can determine other people have done or not? Or is it some secret or some process that you're not even going to be able to determine that someone else is using? So a consideration. So it's really that timing, public versus private information.
Does that answer your question, Dan?
He hung up after asking the question.
Okay. So We're going to take a break. You're listening to Biz Talk and WHBY.
From ordinary tax concerns to extraordinary tax situations, let Alberts and Haling CPAs help you through tax planning, business consulting from startup to sell-off, and more. We specialize in creating financial management plans for your business. Visit AlbertsHaling.com today. Alberts and Haling. Personal connections. Positive results. Securities and advisory services offered through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc. Member FINRA SIPC. Tax and accounting services offered through Alberts and Haling CPAs, which is not affiliated with Woodbury Financial.
Hi, this is Matt Wilcock. I've been helping businesses in this area for over 20 years as a business banker and now as a vice president with WBD, your business finance resource. WBD is a nonprofit company that partners with local lending institutions to offer the SBA 504 loan program. If you are looking to buy commercial, real estate, or equipment, want to lower your down payment and get a 20-year fixed rate under 5%, be sure to ask your banker to show you the 504 option. And don't worry, at WBD we speak SBA, so we will make it easy for you and your banker. For more information on the 504 program, visit WBD.org.
Manage your banking relationship. Don't be managed by it. Lenders will require a copy of your detailed business plan to evaluate the risks associated with making a loan to your business. Many companies have already benefited by using the Priora Business System to prepare their business plan and provide ongoing monitoring of their business cash flow. Priora Business provides you and your lender with the critical information needed to demonstrate your business will be able to repay the loan. Visit PrioraCFM.com or call Tony at 920-450-2840 for more information.
Welcome back to Biz Talk. I'd like to thank our sponsors this morning. They help us bring this show to you each week. They are Fox Communities Credit Union, Alberts and Haling CPAs, Legal Business Edge, Sarah's Company. Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
We also have WBD. They are the 504 experts. Prior Cash Flow Management. And we'd also like to thank Zach Pulowski and the people at Candale Marketing. They keep our website, biztalkwithscore.com, up to date. If you want to go back and listen to any of the prior shows, this show, you can go out to biztalkwithscore.com. And then finally, the business news. Thank you, everybody, for helping us out. And going back to Mike, one of the things we should ask you is for your contact information. There's been a lot of stuff here this morning, and it's a big area. If someone would like to get back to you with a question, how would they do that?
Sure. I'll give you a contact information I have. So Mike at BendelIP.com. That's BendelIP.com. I have a website. It's not yet up and going yet, but that's BendelIP.com is out there. And then phone contact, it'd be a great one, 920-991-0406. And then the physical address in Appleton, north side of Appleton, 2631 North Mead Street, Suite 101 in Appleton.
So if anybody's got any questions and wants more detail on this, particularly a small company that might be, you know, a little bit overwhelmed and listening to this, don't be overwhelmed. Give a call, right?
Absolutely. And I do offer for new clients initial consultation for an hour to try and figure out what do you need. Maybe you don't need any intellectual property protection at this point in time, but maybe down the road to help you, again, not let something slip out the door without your knowing it, so you can protect what it is you've developed and spent hard time and money on.
Without too much detail, but given how much time we have left, but could you kind of talk through what's it going to cost a small business? Because I know a lot of people have been listening to this and thinking about it, but there's a fear of, well, I'm going to cost me $25,000, $30,000 to sit down with a lawyer. What is it, broadly, what is it going to cost for people to look in this area?
It's a very stepped approach, so you can start out with a little bit, and then if things continue to look good, you can continue to make an investment. So, I mean, you start out a couple hundred dollars to start off with to have those, and I offer for free that first hour of time, but for a patent, for example, you're going to want to have a patent search done, and really, I wouldn't recommend one unless I think there may be some good reason to do it. And that's $1,000 to $2,000 to do a patent search, all in cost for time, attorney time, professional searching time. It could be a little less than that, depending on what the subject matter is, or a little more. After that, if you're doing a patent application, maybe a provisional, maybe a jump right to what's called a non-provisional application. That could be, a couple $1,000 to $5,000 to $10,000 on average for an average mechanical invention, average complex invention. It could be more than that if you're talking a business method or some type of machine or some type of medical device. And then from there, you're going to argue with the patent office that you should get a patent, and that could be another $3,000 to $5,000 of money to get that. And you also think about, do I want international rights? If you want to go beyond the United States, just start to multiply what those numbers are, because that's about what it costs in each jurisdiction. But that's something down the road. You have some time on that. From a timing to get your patent, it's going to take you, once you filed, it's on average about 3 years. I've seen them come through as quick as it's about 6 months on some really neat invention that an examiner got really excited about and really helped rush it through the process. But on average, it's about 3 years to get through to the patent, to understand you're going to get a patent or not. And every time, just because you file a patent application, I'd say the current success ratio on getting a patent under the current environment is about 50%. Of chance to get a patent that's worth your money paying for. You'll have some opportunity during that time just to stop. But.
And one of the reasons you really want to see a lawyer, too, is to make sure you're patenting exactly what you're commercializing, correct?
Absolutely, yes, exactly. At least what you're commercializing, and then as much more as may be available.
Okay. So, Mike, we'd like to thank you for coming in this morning. This has been very informative, and it's been good to have you, and good luck with your new firm and things. And we'd like to thank everyone for listening. Hope you have a great Thanksgiving. We'll see you back here next week. Thanks, Sarah and Terry. And
thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you. It's been a great experience.
Thank you.